Welcome back to Alternative Realities. I'm David Kelly, Chief Global Strategist here at JP Morgan Asset Management. While investors have used private equity to enhance returns and access secular market trends for multiple decades, the emergence of venture capital over the last 25 years has provided investors opportunities to earn even higher returns, albeit with increased volatility. The venture capital industry is inherently high risk, high reward, which makes the need for an experienced and skilled manager all the more important. Joining me today to talk about the rise of venture growth equity investing, as well as his outlook on the industry in the current market environment, is Patrick McGoldrick, Managing Partner of JP Morgan Private Capital. Well, Patrick, thanks very much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
So to start with, can you give us give our audience a little bit of a background on your role here at JP Morgan Asset Management, and particularly on the private capital platform?
Of course. So I, by way of background, I'm the managing partner of private capital. And as you asked, David, think of that as the venture and growth equity investment arm within our alternatives practice. So we have the privilege of investing in companies from kind of the seed stage, so the earliest part of the life cycle of a company's journey, all the way through multiple billions of dollars in top line revenue scale, ready to go public, but maybe electing not to right away, across sectors of consequence for us. And we think of those as technology, consumer, and life sciences. And the reason for our business was twofold. One, we saw an opportunity by virtue of being part of JP Morgan with the resources, the scale, the scope. You know, just to give you one sense, we're a $17 billion technology spend company, which if that were a standalone revenue figure, would make us the 200th or so largest Fortune 500 company. And we've got 60,000 technologies, a whole variety of different advantages I'm sure we'll cover. But that was point one, is the breadth and scale of our platform. And then two, we brought together some world-class operators, investors, company builders to help us scale these companies and help these entrepreneurs. And so we're thrilled about what we're building. We're about $1.6 billion of assets under management and scaling, and excited for today's dialogue.
And when you talk about venture and growth investing, just for our audience, can you talk about how that's different from traditional private equity strategies, and what sort of companies can particularly benefit from this venture approach?
Absolutely. And I think it's a really important question, not just from the lens of the company, which we should talk about, but also from the lens of the allocator. So think of venture and growth equity. I started to allude to this, but you might have an entrepreneur come to you, and she has a dream of building a new product, service, a new drug, and they have an idea, a business plan, and perhaps not much else. And they're looking for not just your capital. I think that's, you know, an important area of distinguishment, but your value add, your expertise to find that next member of the team to help think through how to position the product or the service, or how to take a drug to the end stages of eventual commercialization and reimbursement from insurance. And so we'll get involved very early, where there's a lot of risk, but a lot of potential for upside. And it's audacious entrepreneurs who have the belief that what they're creating can change an industry or create an industry. That, as we go through the risk curve, David, it changes. So you get to the Series A, the Series B, you have a little bit more commercial traction, you're building out your go-to-market motion, your sales function to bring a product to market. You get to later stages of growth equity. Again, that risk curve starts to come down a bit, and you're looking for capital to inflect growth more and just prove out a business model that's already currently working. So think of us as the capital, minority capital, that helps accelerate your growth at different stages requiring different levels of expertise. On the private equity side, you often have some degree of, you know, operational efficiency being created, a financial engineering profile that's, you know, complementary to the overall investment strategy. And so it often, not always, involves taking control of an asset, changing management, maybe employing a new cost structure to the business, and deploying leverage. And so the reason the distinguishments matter is, from the mind of the allocator, the risks you take are different. In venture and growth equity, it's very power law driven. So meaning, one, two, three companies can drive the majority of the return in your portfolio. Whereas in private equity, you probably have a more distributed curve of returns associated, a tighter band of outcomes. And then importantly, you have the debt characteristics associated with it. So it's, from the allocator perspective, important to know that. From the entrepreneur perspective, it's really important to understand what are the objectives, the holding periods, the ultimate outcomes that the investor is underwriting to, before you take that capital and have them go on your journey with you.
Well, it sounds like exciting, but also somewhat complex. I mean, how do you have a process? I presume you do, but what is your process for identifying alpha in these companies? And then also, are there efficiencies that you can often suggest to them as they grow?
Absolutely. So the way we start is there's a broad aperture of companies we look at across tech, consumer, and healthcare, of course. We're very thesis driven as it relates to how we invest. So we'll start with a given area. So let's take biotech. We may look in the world of oncology, which unfortunately there's a lot of cancers out there in the world, and try to ascertain, okay, what is a new molecular design that could be interesting here? What's a new approach? What's a new mechanism of action that we could, potentially invest behind? We'll get a deep mosaic of information from companies that operate in a given sub area or specialty within cancer, and then we'll meet with as many operators, entrepreneurs as we can. And that's to give us, what does excellent look like? What are the brightest minds doing? What's the clearest path to success from an eventual clinical trial design and commercialization stage? Same thing on the technology side. How do we put ourselves in the best position to identify those companies and entrepreneurs with the greatest degree of success? And then alpha for us, unlike the public markets where it's, benchmarked of a spread relative to a public market indice, for us, it's how do we create value for these companies? At the earliest stages, we have a team that has built some of the most iconic healthcare companies in the world that leans into helping a new founded entrepreneur build their vision. And on the technology side, it's every advantage that this firm has to offer, whether it be customer introductions, partnership opportunities, and frankly, accelerating the revenue associated with the businesses we invest in. And so that's a little bit of the way we think about alpha in the context of the private markets, is more the information asymmetry and the value creation that we can derive for the companies we invest in.
And then, so just looking at the business right now, I mean, what's the current pipeline? Is a lot of dry powder on the sidelines? Are firms being very selective in terms of what they'll invest in? How do you see the overall market?
Well, you've certainly done a great job of cataloging what's happened in the lead up to 2021, and then naturally the correction in 22. So I won't bore our listeners with that, but I will say it's really important to talk about the lag effect of private equity and venture and growth relative to the public markets. And what do I mean by that? Well, since 2021, David, and this is not talked about enough, you've had 2,000 venture and growth firms close their doors. So the flight to quality, the investors, the allocators are saying, what's your right to win? What's your ability to deploy capital effectively? So yes, there's still this dry powder overhang that's well documented and covered in mainstream media. What hasn't been as well covered is there's a narrowing of capital into those platforms, those investment firms with an exceptional ability to create value. And so take 2024, $71 billion of capital was raised. Nine firms took home more than 50% of that. So what we think about for pipeline is you have this correction. So 2021, you had this abundance of IPO activity, abundance of M&A. There were 600 companies created at $1 billion of value or more. And that's just not sustainable. There's 2,000 companies representing $4 trillion of value in the private market. That's not going to be the case in 5 years. So then you have to bifurcate. What are the sustainable, durable business models that have a right to exist, that have defensibility in their business, characteristics, positioning, and those that frankly just were part of the excess, but it's competitive. And so for us, as we look across tech and healthcare, how do we position ourselves effectively with a prepared mind? How do we add that value we alluded to before? And then ultimately, what are the segments that we think have the greatest market potential? And I know we're going to cover a little bit of that in today's discussion.
So I mean, obviously, we focus a lot on tech and healthcare, but in public markets, we certainly spend a lot of time worrying about concentration risk around the Mag 7. Do you see some potential concentration risk in your own portfolio?
So it's interesting because in the private markets, of course, you're building a portfolio of 20 to 30 companies, let's say, right? And so you're seeking to have a broad diversification of companies at inception of your initial check. But in venture and growth, by virtue of the power law, you are actually looking to concentrate in your winners over time and defend your ownership. So take our life sciences practice. We'll invest in companies and own 60, 70%, if not more, of the company at our first check. And then it's a question of, do we see enough progress such that the clinical trial design is effective, that there's some early readout data that we're excited about? Are there market dynamics that encourage acquisition in a given category? On the technology side, kind of similarly, are we seeing companies that are really accelerated growth, that have underlying profitability associated with their product or service, that just clear signal that this is going to be a great public company? But we're diversified in the sense of number of companies. We're picking what we believe to be the best assets in a given theme or area or sub area within our funds. But intentionally, we do want concentration in the companies that we think are going to be the standout winners and just keep backing them over time. So that's a bit of a difference in the world of the public markets, to your point.
Well, I think also, I mean, clearly, I absolutely get the point that just a few big winners are really what make your year. And sort of make your sort of decade in this business, but also I think the focus on, you know, the concentration is a result of performance by these companies and potential by these companies, rather than just the flavor of the day in the public markets, which unfortunately you see a lot of froth and enthusiasm, not very informed buying in public markets. But this is really about just operationally, what are going to be the winners here? And that's how you end up with that concentration, if you have it.
Yep, that's right. That's absolutely well said.
And then, so looking at the growth equity lens, you know, what sectors are you most interested in and focused on?
Well, since you talked about froth and Mag 7, you can't talk about venture and growth equity without talking about AI. And we'll talk about some of the risks and perils of it. But there is a lot of reason to be excited within technology. And let me start at the macro framing. Technology is 5% of GDP that's expected to grow threefold over the next decade. That makes sense because our, you know, our phones, our tablets, our computers, we spend 6 to 8 hours a day. You probably are averaging 20, would be my guess, in front of these electronic devices. And so it stands to reason that that should be a pretty important part of value creation over the next decade or two. AI, we fundamentally believe, I think a lot of people share this view, of course, that there's a ubiquity to it across all sectors. It's not a vertical application anymore. It's viewed as something that will power businesses. It's definitely a paradigm shift, similar to cloud computing, mobile, you know, whether it's the mainframe, you pick your evolution. But inherent in that is a little bit of that, you know, disjointed valuation at times. But it's remarkable to see the scale of these businesses. And over every decade of disruption in technology, a new class of leaders emerges. And that's where venture and growth equity tend to back those companies. And so I think AI disrupting traditional industry at the infrastructure layer, so the aggregation, categorization, the usefulness of your data, the application layer. So take a chemicals industry. Before, there was no technology. It's pen and paper. Now you have these technologies that help you aggregate your point of view, understand the chemical properties of the products you're making, and derive insight as to how you should make the next product. So technology, I think there's just so much opportunity. And in healthcare, I think what's underappreciated is it's 10% of global GDP, 20% of the domestic economy. And if you were to ask the average American, what are they worried about, education, food, or healthcare, it's healthcare is a primary concern. And that's because people are living longer. They're more able to ingest both medication and devices to improve quality of life. And so we have the best appreciation we've had in history of the human genome, biology, chemistry, the drugs being created to inhibit disease are remarkable. There are things, you know, being created in neurodegenerative disease, for example, to slow the progression of Alzheimer's, to slow the progression of some of the most devastating effects of cancer. And so for us, broadly, we love the categories we're in. And I summarize that with my favorite stat, which is as a venture and growth equity investor, we're literally expected to be optimists. What is possible versus what isn't? Mm-hmm. And 8 of the 10 largest companies in the world, created at all different times, going public at different times, were venture-backed at one point in time. And so for us, great entrepreneurs always find a will to win. And it's just backing those companies and happy to dive deeper into sectors. But I think that's the right framing as it relates to what we're excited about.
Well, I think that's a fascinating statistic in terms of long-term winners. But let's bring it back up to sort of more to the here and now right now. Because you know, M&A is obviously part of the business too. And how do you see M&A in the overall industry? And then do you see changes in the regulatory environment with this new administration? You know, how does that affect your business?
Yes. So I think the last 5-6 years from an M&A perspective have been a bit more restrictive. And so we certainly hope that the new administration and the new FTC chair is more favorably leaning towards M&A. Now, I wouldn't go as far to say that it's a complete, you know, dislocation from previous views held by the previous administration. And I think the Google divestiture of Chrome is a good example of that, that's likely to continue to proceed for now. We'll see. But M&A should be more vibrant. We have a good test case. Google is acquiring one of those companies that naturally is a new category creator in Wiz, a cybersecurity business, $32 billion. There's a large, you know, breakup fee associated with that deal from our understanding. And so there's a little bit of wait and see on the technology side as it relates to the mega tech names and their ability to deploy capital. Healthcare, it's structural. There's $2 trillion of M&A that's taken place over the last 5 years. And we'll talk about these dynamics, but M&A is the lifeblood of innovation in healthcare. And so we feel favorably disposed towards the new administration. It's still early, but we are hearing more and more companies viewing that as an attractive exit, both with private equity and strategic buyers.
Oh, well, finally, Patrick, you and I both work for JP Morgan Asset Management. And obviously, it's kind of, I personally find it kind of special place to work. But what sort of advantages do you think JP Morgan Asset Management offers as a partner for the companies they invest in?
So I think it's several fold, you know, and we talked a little bit about AI earlier, and the firm, just JP Morgan alone, has targeted a $1 to $2 billion of efficiencies to be gained by virtue of AI. And that matters, David, because when you're looking at premiums that range from 30% at the early stage and 200% at the later stage for AI companies, how do you pick the best winners and what has the utility for enterprise level customers? Well, there's one of the largest, you know, financial institutions in the world. Deriving that insight on the positioning, the effectiveness of a solution, it matters. We cover 35,000 commercial banking clients. We mentioned the technology spend, the technologists, but in venture and growth equity, it's your ability to identify, pick, win, and ultimately partner with the best companies to build a portfolio. On identifying, we are seeing thousands of companies across technology and healthcare. On the, you know, picking those companies, we're bringing in expertise from every line of business, whether it's cyber or AI or infrastructure. And then ultimately winning and adding value. I think we've covered that in great depth. So being at JP Morgan is incredible. And then the last thing I'd say is the firm attracts the best talent. And I'd be remiss not to say this, because if you have an amazing ship without a good captain, it doesn't do much for you. And I think on the healthcare side, Steve Squinto, who was a third employee at Regeneron, $75 billion public company, sold his company Alexion for $39 billion in 2013 to AstraZeneca, and then built a number of great companies and technology side. We have Paris and Topher, who are terrific back companies like Figma, Databricks, Celonis, you know, Know Before, Wiz. These are people with demonstrable abilities to take an idea and create value. And that's what we have built. We've just given them what we think, with all humility intended, the best possible toolkit to effectuate that value. And so certainly privileged to be here and excited for all the advantages the platform has for us.
It's certainly a lot. You sit in an exciting seat, and I think there's a lot of opportunities in the space. So thank you so much, Patrick, for joining us on Alternative Realities.
My pleasure. Thanks, David.
This material is for information purposes only. The views, opinions, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions are those of the speaker and may differ from those expressed by JP Morgan Asset Management or by other areas of JP Morgan Chase & Company. Any companies referenced are shown for illustrative purposes only and are not intended as a recommendation. We believe the information provided here is reliable but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors. This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. J.P. Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.